A seasoned MBA admissions pro is ready to advise you. Welcome to the 163rd episode of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can high-five the person next to you and shout, "Yes, I'm in." Not only in, but in at the best program for you. Our guest today is an incredibly experienced MBA admissions professional. He started as an associate director of MBA admissions in 1994 at USC Marshall, moved up to director in 1997, and to assistant dean of MBA admissions at Marshall in 2007. In addition, he served briefly at different points in time as interim vice dean of the MBA program and interim executive director, MBA Career Services. Plus, his experience was not at all limited to USC Marshall. Keith Vaughn, today's guest, also had multi-year stints on the board of GMAC and on the board of the Consortium for Graduate Study and Management. He has met and worked closely with all the leaders at a diverse array of full-time, part-time, and executive MBA programs. Breadth and depth in MBA admissions defines Keith's expertise. Now, I've been privileged to talk to many seasoned, experienced, knowledgeable professionals and extraordinary individuals on Admissions Straight Talk. But today is an extra special privilege because not only is Keith bringing his insights and qualifications to this episode of Admissions Straight Talk, he also just joined Accepted's consulting staff and will be helping Accepted's clients one-on-one, as well as helping all of you Admissions Straight Talk listeners who tuned in to this particular show. Keith, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thanks, Linda. I'm happy to be here.
And I'm delighted to be speaking with you today. Now, can you tell us, first of all, can you give a little bit of background about yourself? In my intro, I gave a little bit, but where are you from? How did you get into MBA admissions?
Sure, Linda. I'll start from the beginning, I guess. I'm a military brat, and that means that my father was in the service. He was a cook in the Air Force, and I was born at a military base called West Point in New York. My father was from Georgia. My mother was...
I heard of West Point.
You heard of West Point?
I heard of West Point, yeah.
Yeah, some very famous people came out of there, and I won't count myself as one. I was just born there. But then later on, I actually got accepted into the Air Force Academy, and during my college days, I was actually going to go. I had a scholarship. I had a congressional appointment. And at the last minute, it was right around the Vietnam era, and I decided that I wouldn't go into the military, and I went to Amherst instead. Years after Amherst, I decided I would go get an MBA, and during the time I was getting my MBA, from 92 to 94, the associate dean at the time, this professor, his name was Mark Zupan, he later became dean at Arizona and also the dean at Rochester. He actually pulled me in and asked me to work on a project in the career area. And so as I was doing that, when you look at the output from a business school, you have to look at the input, obviously. And admissions was the input channel. And that's how I got into admissions. I started doing that, and it was exciting. It dealt with people. It dealt with what I didn't realize. It had a lot of travel involved with it. And as a military brat, I traveled every 3 to 4 years of my life. And so with admissions, I found out over the years, I actually did over 3 million miles with American Airlines, traveling around the world.
Wow.
Meeting fabulous people all around the globe. And initially, I thought I would be doing this for 3 years, and I had a counterpart over at UCLA who was also an MBA grad, and more MBAs were gravitating toward doing this particular job. And we said, her name was Marjorie, and we were like, okay, we'll do this for 3 years, and then if we become the director, we'll stay a little while longer. If not, we'll just leave it, right, and do something else.
Wow.
In 3 years, I became the director of admissions, and that's how it started.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's just take it a little forward. You were the admissions director or assistant dean of admissions at USC Marshall for roughly 20 years. When you were an admissions director, what is the one thing you really wished applicants would understand that they just didn't get? What would you like, wish you could grab them by the shoulders, shake them up a little bit, and tell them?
That's a good question, Linda. I don't know if there is one thing, but there's something that comes to mind, though. And
it could be two
when
also.
You look into the eyes of all, okay, when you look into all these applicants' heads, no matter where you met them, whether you met them in New York or London or Delhi, wherever it was, you have to convince them that you're not trying to trick them. There are no tricks to this process. Admissions is looking for good people, and there's no formula that you can follow. There's no formula that you can put together. There's no multiple regression that you can run and figure out how this process actually works. It's very people-oriented. But just to get them to understand that we weren't trying to trick them, that we were trying to get to know them. And that's the one thing I would try to get people to realize when they're meeting with admissions people is that they honestly do want to get to know who you are. And even though I would throw a curveball now and then into an interview question or something, it wasn't meant to trick them. It was meant to see how they think on their feet and to get them talking comfortably and easily to tell their story.
Okay, that's something good to know. I would sometimes, some of the chats, especially the online chats, I would even ask the admissions committee members, I said, excuse me, are you a human being? And they would laugh, and they would say, yeah, okay, you know, you need to realize that the people reading your applications are human beings, and they're trying to get to know you as human beings. They're not robots. They're not machines. And, you know, that was one of the things that I think that applicants don't get or sometimes struggle with a bit.
Yeah. No, and that's true. And to understand that we get tired, and we're reading lots and lots of applications, and toward the end of the process, the end of the cycle, and that's not to defer people from applying in the last rounds or anything, but they have to understand that we are people and we do get tired. And so your application really does have to stand out to catch our attention at different times in the cycle.
Okay, great. Your past response actually leads to my next question. When you were reviewing applications, what did you review first and why?
That's something that applicants always want to know as well, right? Like, is there something in the application that everyone looks at first? And the obvious answer would be the GMAT score, because everyone thinks that's the most important. So the thing for me, though, personally, was just like before I go to the movies, I like to look at Rotten Tomatoes and see how they've rated the particular film. And if it's rated high, I think I might stand a good chance of enjoying the film.
Right.
With regard to applications, the AWA, when that score actually started being given to us from GMAC, was very important to me to look at, because if it had a high score, like if it was a 5 or a 6 or a 5.5, then I knew I was about to have a good read, that it was going to be interesting, that this person could write. And so I was looking forward to getting into the meat of that application. I do a quick peek after that, at the GMAT and the GPA, just to make sure that the person is bright and that it wasn't going to be someone I might have to take a risk on, even if I liked the story. And then spend about 20 to 30 seconds on the resume. And that's about enough before I actually start turning pages.
So the AWA was really important to you. You're the first person other than Rotman who said that they really counted that heavily.
Uh-huh. I just thought it was a great indicator of writing skills, and as GMAT began to understand how to score it better and you know, trust the people who were scoring it, it really is a good indicator. Because if you see something less than, let's say, a 4, then you should expect that essay is going to be a struggle. And if it isn't, if it reads like a 5 or 6, then it raises an antenna. Like, did this person actually write their essay?
Right.
Are they using these consulting services, right? Like the one I just joined.
And, no, it's not the consulting service. It's the writing services that you have to worry about.
Right, exactly. So the AWA was an indicator for like being able to sift through that and get a sense for, you know, are you really dealing with the applicant who's applying to your school?
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you advise applicants to go to approach the application, and specifically to approach writing the essays?
Again, I go back to what we were talking about earlier when I said that there are no tricks to this process,
right?
That I think the applicant should really feel that the school is trying to get to know who they are. So for them to be authentic, for them to really tell their story in a way that it's coming across in their voice. They're being themselves, and as much as they possibly can, you know, maybe they need to ask their friends, maybe they need to ask their peers at work to look at things that they're writing down, to think about the stories that they're trying to tell and say, does this really come across as who you think I am? Because that's what we want. And it's not easy. We understand that that's probably hard for people to be self-reflective and to think that that's going to be okay, that they actually have a story. You know, everyone doesn't have to be an Olympic athlete or, you know, the person that discovered something really great in this world, but they're all unique. And they have to figure out what their unique perspective is.
I think sometimes also just almost in a childlike way, you know, when they give some, their first answers is likely to be rather superficial. And if they kind of ask mm-hmm. themselves, well, why am I saying that? And like, and again, like a child, and you give them, they give another answer, and then, well, why is that so? And why? If they go down a few layers, they may actually get to something that's a little bit more distinctive, deeper.
Exactly. And understand what motivated them and how it motivated them.
Right.
Yeah, those things are important.
Again, almost, you know, you ever talk with a child and they just keep saying, why?
Yeah, that happens, and it should happen, right, in the early stages of their development. So in the early stages of developing an application and developing your story, yeah, you should go through those same questions.
Okay.
And like you said, peel the layers back and really get the sense of who you are.
Right. Not an easy process, but necessary. Now, right. You also served for 10 years on the consortium's board. For those unfamiliar with the consortium, could you briefly describe it? And then what is critical for consortium applicants to keep in mind as they complete their applications?
Sure. Well, I didn't just serve on the board of the consortium. I was actually a consortium student. I mean, that's how I finance my education through business school.
Okay.
So I'm a consortium alum.
Uh-huh.
And then sitting on the board gave me a different perspective, sitting around the table with several other schools. I don't even know the exact number of schools that I'm in the consortium right now. I think the number is like 15 or something.
It's been growing rapidly every year. They're adding a
school. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was in the single digits when I first joined the consortium. And the mission of the consortium was to increase the numbers of people of color into the ranks of business. And specifically into the ranks of business and the U.S. I mean, it was about big corporations. In fact, I think the first class of consortium students all went to the largest organizations in the country. And today, the mission is still very much the same, except for anyone and everyone is eligible to apply through the consortium if they support the values of the consortium. And the value and the mission-driven statement is about pushing the numbers, increasing the numbers of people of diverse backgrounds into the ranks of business. And it's important that even people who are African American or Hispanic or Native American, they still have to show in their applications that they value the mission, that they made a contribution. It's like you have to use examples for how you are helping this mission be successful over time. And the hard thing, again, because I think applicants are always looking for the trick and say, well, if I apply through the consortium, is that going to be a negative? Or if I use the regular application from the school, is it going to hurt me or help me to apply through the consortium or not? It's the same process. Admissions people from the schools that represent the consortium are going to look at your application the way that they would look at it, whether you FedExed it in or hand-delivered it or push the button and it was electronically delivered, it's still the same information that they're going over. They're going to make decisions based upon your ability to make a contribution to their schools, to be competitive in the ranks of the schools that you're applying to. So the positives with regard to the consortium is that it costs less money to apply to multiple programs, you know, because they have package deals. So you spend, I don't know, I think the number is $250 to apply to up to six schools. And you still have to interview. You still have to go through the rigors of getting into schools. And then the connection between corporations that are looking for talent and the consortium is a very, very strong one. And so that gives you another network, you know, to help you accelerate your career progress and start meeting with these organizations prior even to going to school, because the orientation program takes, if you're accepted into one of these consortium schools, you're invited into an orientation that takes place months before school starts, and you're already beginning to make connections with organizations that are looking to hire you. So there's, you know, big upside if you're a part of that process. And the consortium's been around now for 50 years, so they've been doing this a long time.
Right. And there are, I looked it up while you were talking, Keith, there are 18 schools in the consortium right now, okay. 18 member schools, including Haas, CMU Tepper, Dartmouth Tuck, Georgetown McDonough, Michigan Ross, UNC Kenneth Flagler,
Virginia.
Yes. I'm looking at the list. USC Marshall, Virginia, Darden, Wisconsin, UCLA Anderson, Cornell, Johnson Emory, Indiana Kelly, NYU Stern, Rochester Simon, UT McCombs, Washington Olin, and Yale. So you really have a lot of schools now.
No, absolutely. And when I went to the consortium, the only West Coast school was USC. And given that I had gone to high school in Northern California, I would have leaned more toward Berkeley had they been a member of the organization, you know, at the time that I applied to the consortium.
Right.
But now
right.
there are three West Coast schools, USC, Berkeley, and UCLA.
Right. Now it's really all around the country. And they're good schools. They're fine schools.
No, absolutely.
Now, for a little bit more, listeners, for more about the consortium, please see the consortium's website, but we also interviewed on Admission Straight Talk one of the directors of the consortium in episode 64, so you can find it at exhibit.com/64. It was a couple of years ago, but I'm sure that a lot of the values haven't changed, and many of the things will still be applicable. Now, Keith,
right.
in addition to your service on the consortium's board, you were also elected to GMAC's board. So you worked with many admissions offices and admissions professionals from a broad array of MBA programs. Applicants sometimes have a hard time discerning the strengths or the differences between the different programs, other than, you know, the rankings and rumor mills. There are lots of information on the debates gone amok. About the strengths and weaknesses of different programs. What do you think applicants should be looking at and looking for as they research programs?
Linda, I like the way that you threw out rankings and rumor mills in the same sentence. Because there's a lot of bad information out there, and then there's a lot of information that people still have to, they have to dig beneath the rankings to really understand what's going on at that school and why is it important to them, right?
So
I think making decisions about business school is a very individual decision, and people need to, again, understand what it is they're going after an MBA for, where they expect to see themselves immediately after business school, 5 years out, 10 years out, you know, for the rest of their career. And so part of it, I think that they need to step back and take a big, broad look at what it is that they're trying to do, and geography might be of interest to people, because business schools don't just exist in the United States. There are very good schools in Asia. There are good schools in Europe. There are schools around the globe that they might want to take a look at, and how does that really fit with what it is that they're trying to do? Like years ago, I spoke to I think I was in China at a dinner and met an American expat who was planning on going to business school, and you know, we were initially talking about schools in the U.S., and she ended up going to INSEAD, which mm-hmm. was a great fit for her. So the other thing that students should look at is size. You know, where do they feel most comfortable? Is that classroom going to be 90 students, or is it going to be 30 students? Is the entire class size, is it going to be 900? Is it going to be 200? Where are they going to be most comfortable? They need to understand something about themselves and something about the school that we always talk about fit, and that's part of it. It's trying to understand where they're going to be most comfortable. And then they get into the nitty-gritty, and once they know what it is that they're actually trying to do, the curriculum at a school should be of interest to them. The first year of business school across the globe is probably going to be similar in terms of the disciplines that people are going to get out of it. You know, obviously you're expected to do finance, you're expected to do marketing, you're expected to have some understanding about strategy. So you're going to get the nuts and bolts in the first year, and then the second year for schools that are the traditional two-year MBA programs, you're going to have room to explore and dig deeper into the area of your particular interest. And that's where you really have to research and find out if that school delivers the things that you're most interested in. And then once, you know, students, as much as possible, we try to get them to visit the schools that they're interested in. And we understand that for some people, depending on where they come from, you know, if they're coming from small country in Africa or some remote area in the U.S. even, maybe they don't have either the finances or the wherewithal to go out and visit all the particular schools. But if they do, it gives them an opportunity to really get a gut feeling when they're on campus, you know, when they're talking to students and think, do I belong in this environment? You know, how do I feel walking on this campus? What's it going to be like to be in this city? You know, do I need to be in a big city or can I be in a remote area? You know, and they have to answer all of those questions. It's a big investment of your time, not just money, but in the 2 years that you spend there, and you need to explore it.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say to people. And being on the board, you know, being on GMAC board, I did it very early in my introduction to the whole admissions thing. Mm-hmm. And it was a big transition period. It was a time when the admissions board was changing from primarily admissions directors over to deans at different schools. And it was a tense transition period, and it gave me some understanding of the political forces within the business environment. And there was a woman on the board with me from LBS, from London Business School. And that, for me personally, developed into a relationship where I actually did an employee exchange and went to LBS and worked in their admissions office for a couple of weeks and went to Russia with them when they did a recruiting event. So that was a great opportunity that came out of being on the board at GMAC.
Right. Obviously, you met admissions officers from around the world as you were on GMAC. And also, you mentioned to me when we met a few weeks ago that you work, you know, all the various tours, you get to know the admissions people. And obviously, you, you know, you do spend some time talking shop, inevitably. So you got inside.
We also picked out great restaurants and cities from around the world, and we did it as a group. You know, we drank wine together. We broke bread together, yeah. And you develop strong relationships. And that's another thing that I think that students understand, that these schools are competing with one another, but they don't realize how much we know each other and how much we respect what everyone is trying to do in terms of putting together their class at each individual school. Now, we don't share information, you know, about an application with when you're reviewing an applicant at one school and you know that they apply to the other school. You don't sit and talk specifics, but at the same time, you're very much aware that that you're recruiting the best possible students that you can find, and that there's going to be some overlap.
Right. Okay. Let's. We've been talking more general strategy, little bit the essays. But you, of course, also interviewed thousands of MBA applicants in your career. What's your favorite piece of advice for applicants preparing for a blind MBA admissions interview?
You know, it's sort of that question reminds me of like real estate. And they say, what's the most important thing in real estate? And they say, location, location, location.
Right.
And when I think of preparing for an interview, I think it really is about preparation, that you can never do too much preparing for your interview. You have to take it seriously. You have to understand what it is that you're trying to communicate to the school, and also come prepared to ask some questions, you know, ask some relevant questions that are going to be important to you as a student and things that are happening in the school that are not obviously answered on the website or from material that you can easily get on your own, but that say something with respect to the research that you've been doing or the communication that you've had with either students or alumni, and you want to know more. And then, you know, the bottom line is, yeah, you also have to be able to relax, right? This isn't a fitness test. It's not meant to be a powerful, stressful event. it's meant to be a two-way communication. And so you need to be able to have a mature conversation and make sure that you're getting across, you know, what it is that you prepared to get across when you finish with that interview.
Okay. Well, sounds like great advice. It's July now. The round one MBA deadlines are approximately 2 months away. What should applicants be doing now? Yeah, it's really, that's what it is.
I know, the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking. What should applicants be doing now if their target program's essay questions aren't out yet?
Right. I've actually seen some of your responses to students on questions like this.
Okay.
And they're so anxious to start writing the essays. And for many schools, the essays don't change that much, right? So they can look at past essays and not actually try to answer specifically what was on those particular essays. But as they start to figure out what story they're going to tell, they have to understand that that's what all schools are really asking for. It's like, what is your story? Who are you? So they can begin to do some brainstorming and start not actually writing a final draft, but write a draft, right? Write something that begins to tell the story that you think you want to tell, that's going to talk about an achievement, that's going to talk about a hurdle, that's going to talk about something that you think is significant in your life. But on top of that, you should still be researching their websites, you know, and understand that school. On the website, there are so many ways that schools put applicants in touch with their students. And, you know, you can even develop, if you know a particular club at a school, let's say you want to be a part of the high-tech club at school X, right? But you can go on their website, and they will show you, like, the president of that particular club. You can email that student directly and get information that might be of interest to you. So use that opportunity, to get in touch with a student that's on the ground, that's working in an area that you think you might be interested in. So there's lots of information out there. There's no one season for researching. You should be researching all the
time. Right.
What's interesting to see out here, I'm sitting near a parking lot to, like, Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is I've never noticed this before, and, you know, until you sit here and just observe, that there are these voltage-free areas for people to plug in their cars. That didn't exist 5 years ago.
Oh, no, right? It didn't. We actually have an electric car, and we are starting to, you know, look for those things. Yeah. Yeah.
You can come to Whole Foods and just plug in.
That's right. That's right. Okay. All right. So we've discussed interviews, and you've discussed the importance of research. And I think, again, one thing that one can do now, even if the questions are not yet out, and of course they're coming out rapidly every day, is you can visit schools. And it may not be the ideal time to visit schools because most schools don't have class in session, but you can still visit them, or you can schedule visits for when class is in session. Keith, what do you recommend that applicants look for when they visit schools?
I guess this question goes back to the one of fit, right? And fit isn't always a conscious thing. You're not going there and say, let's see, if I step over here and spend 10 minutes in this particular building, you know, do I feel good about the school?
Right. I'm a size X. Is this school a size Y, or is it an X? Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Exactly. Or I look around and I don't really see people that look like me. You know, is that going to be a problem, right? It's like, it's in your gut, you know, the feel, and it's not just the school, it's not just the business school, it's also the campus. You know, you're going to be a part of a wider campus. Walk around the campus. You know, go early. If you're going there for an interview or even for a visit, try to get a complete picture of where the school is at in the city that it's in, or in the area that it's located, and get a feel for the whole campus. And then when you're on campus, hopefully, you know, even many schools have summer sessions. So even if you go during the summer, you can still have an opportunity to sit in a class and look at students, talk to students. And I suggest finding students during their informal settings. There are usually student cafes. There's a student lounge. You know, go sit in that lounge and talk to students that are there. And, you know, you're talking to real people. They generally have a warm sort of a warm feeling about visitors that come to their campus, and they're interested in helping you understand sort of what's going on there. And in the classroom, this is one cautionary piece of advice that I would give to people is you're there to listen, you're there to watch, you're there to observe. You're not there to participate. You know, unless you are really called upon to say something, you're really not there to speak. And sometimes students get a little excited, you know, when they're in these classrooms, and they think that they're supposed to talk, or they're talking to the student sitting next to them. They really don't want to do that. You know, you don't want to draw attention to yourself in a negative way in the classroom. So really, you're there to listen and observe.
I would think that when you're visiting schools as a prospective MBA applicant, you don't want to draw negative attention to yourself in any way, in any interaction.
Yeah, that's true. But some people do. And, you know, we've had people sort of combing their hair while they're in the classroom, or you know, chewing gum, or doing something that they should, you know, that you would think people would know that they shouldn't do these things, but sometimes it happens.
Okay. What advice do you have for MBA reapplicants?
Reapplicants, hopefully, if they've done all the things that we've told them to do before they applied the first time, then they're well informed about the school. They know what this process is all about. But they should absolutely take advantage of, like, at USC, we have something we call deny counseling. Most schools have something like that, whether they do it over the phone. Generally, you're not doing this in person because it's not generally a nice conversation to have to have at all times. But you're trying to inform students, or the school has been informing students of how they can improve their applications, you know, if they do decide to reapply. And you should have gone through that deny counseling that's offered so that you can stay positive and you can do the things that are necessary to make sure that your reapplication is fresh. You know, you can't resubmit the same thing. No matter, even if you think the only reason you didn't get in was because you applied late and you were just as qualified as everyone else, you still need to present a fresh package. It's generally an abbreviated package for a reapplicant, but you want to make sure that there's something new in that package when you reapply.
Right. Otherwise, you come across as being, even if to take your example of the person who applied late and feels that they were completely qualified and they presented the qualifications well, if they present the same qualifications the first day the application opens, all they're doing is saying, I've stagnated for the last 6 months or whatever period of time. And that's not the impression they want to make.
Exactly.
Okay. What really irritated you in terms of applicant behavior as an admissions dean?
Ooh. Applicants were generally, you know, well-behaved. But I think that the most difficult part for me with regard to admissions was yield management. You know, when you get to the end of the process, you know, because you're going through thousands of applications and you're putting them into different categories. And some people are on your wait list. Some people are admitted, and some people are denied. And you're still having communication with each one of these populations, you know, like the denied group, some of them want to come back and have denied counseling immediately. It's not going to happen immediately. There's going to be a time period to have that conversation, and schools are going to let you know when that is. People on the wait list, there's a way to manage the wait list, and that's probably the most difficult group to get them to behave in a way that's respectful and to be able to let you know that they're still interested, that they want to know what they can do to move off of the wait list into that admitted package. But here's the group that was probably irritable in the sense of you're always admitting more people than you have in your class, right? Because you're only going to yield a certain group of people that you admit. Mm-hmm. And you know what your yield rate is. But within that group, though, you're still going to have people backing out at different times, like people who indicate to you that they're actually coming. When they send you a deposit, you're going to get a higher yield than the people who have actually deposited. But some of those people are still at their programs, and that's understandable. But the the earlier and more confident that you can be in the people that are actually showing up on your campus, then you can deal with the folks on your wait list in a more positive way. You know, you can let them know that, yes, there are going to be some openings, that yes, we know what's happening with the people who've been admitted. And, you know, so dealing with that whole yield management piece could be the most irritable for me as an admissions director, you know, when people aren't being honest in that process.
Right. And then there's also very little you can do about it.
Well, no, I mean, you have to deal with that every year. And you know, you're trying to smooth it out. I had a student that, and I'm sure there are many examples like this, but I remember years ago, I actually had a consortium student who we had given a full scholarship to, and I knew she was a very competitive student, and she was actually waffling between coming to USC at the time and, can believe it or not, going to Stanford. And she was a young student at the time. She was a young person. She was like 20, 23 years old. And I told her that she had a really great opportunity, you know, that Derek up at Stanford was offering her something that she might not see again in her lifetime. And she really wanted to take that seriously. But she lived in L.A. She thought she wanted to stay in L.A. Her family wanted to keep her in L.A. And I did my best to make sure that she considered the opportunity that was in front of her, and she ended up going to Stanford, which I thought was the best decision for her at the time.
Sure. That makes sense. Yes, absolutely. I also think the point you made about being on the wait list and showing or not showing judgment, which can mean what way you get off, which can heavily influence the way in which you get off the wait list, is something that many applicants just don't fully realize.
No, exactly. And if they don't get off and they've left a bad taste in your mouth about the interaction that you had with them, and then they become a reapplicant in the end, like, they have to realize that, or they should realize, every interaction that you have with admissions is a potential plus or minus in your application.
Right.
The impression that you make on the receptionist, the impression that you make on the students that you interact with, all of that information comes back to the admissions committee in some form or fashion, and you want it to be positive.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that you know, some of them at least don't understand. Anyway, what do you wish I would have asked you?
What could you have asked me? Or you could ask me how much fun I had.
How much fun did you have as an admissions dean and director?
Because over the 20 years, I mean, I was surprised. Like, the first 10 years went by really fast because there was a lot of learning. There was a lot of interaction with my peers, you know, whether I was on the boards with them or where I was traveling with them in different places around the world. And that relationship was really one that helped me stay in it for as long as I did. And also you get, you know, everyone looks for, like, you don't just look for how much money you make while you're doing these jobs, because this wasn't about money, but you get some positive feedback from students who go through the program and do things that you didn't think that they were capable of doing, or do things that you thought that they were capable of, and you took a risk in allowing them to do it in the environment that you provided for them, right? And I'm in touch with so many students that have been through our program, and I get emails still to this day. I get a thank you from some student who's now not a student anymore, an alum who's a managing director in New York, or an alum who just did very interesting things and just wants to say thank you. And I don't think, you know, I'm going to say this little plug for my colleagues, that you don't get enough thank yous from students, because they dismiss admissions the moment that they get into the program. But we do work with a lot of students, and a lot of programs have these ambassadors for their admissions offices, and they're just great to interact with, you know, over the period of time that they're in the program.
Right.
And so that's a little bit of what you leave. A personal piece for what you take away is watching them make progress, and also, you know, the fun that you can have in doing the job. Because it's a challenging job, but it can be very rewarding.
That's great insight. Thank you. Any last minute tips for MBA applicants out there?
Just to stay positive, right? That there's more than one school that you should be applying to, and more than one school that you can see yourself actually being a student at, and just be positive that you're going to make that match and it's going to happen for you. That you can get an MBA. It doesn't necessarily have to be that school, that dream school that you think you should go to, that there's only one school, because there's more than one school, and you should research them and get a good feel for it. And if you're going to be successful in life, you're going to be successful no matter which school you go to.
That's a great perspective on the whole process. Keith, thank you so much for joining me today. As always, I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, Linda.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Listener, you can learn more about Keith Vaughn on his bio page at Accepted. I'll link to it in the show notes at accepted.com/163. Thank you, too, for tuning in to this episode. Again, this number 163. If you found this show helpful, I have a favor to ask. Please share your perspective on iTunes. There's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave a review. Doing so helps potential listeners find us and is much appreciated. And again, the show notes are at accepted.com/163. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.